Hello and welcome to Ops and Hops, the podcast for those who like beer but have to work in tech to afford it. I'm here with Steven Sadowski. I am your host, Derek Morgan. And today I am drinking a Spiteful Brewing Working for the Weekend IPA. It is a double. I decided for my first show, I probably ought to hit it a little harder than normal just to hopefully ease my way through it. Steven, what did you bring along?
Yeah, I've got a Burning Bush Brewery Noah's Kayak Golden Ale. So it is a pretty good local brewery here in Chicago. Pretty happy to have known the owner since they opened. So grabbed one of those yesterday afternoon.
All right, fantastic. Yeah, I looked that one up. It is not far from where this brewery was as well. So Spiteful and Burning Bush, I think, are probably about a mile apart in Chicago.
Yeah, we actually have a whole grouping of them up here on the north side. So Dovetail's walkable as well. And then, you know, you got some old trusted folks around as well. So I think Irving Park Brewing's about a mile and a half from here, some other stuff. We used to have Twisted Hippo. For those that have been around the Chicago scene for a while, Twisted Hippo was in a really good rut, and then their place burned down. So
as a lot of businesses who end up in ruts end up.
Yeah. So it's so they're brewing again. You can find them around Chicago at a couple of different places. And yeah, want to plug them too, because the hippos are great folks.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, after living in Denver, I thought that was kind of the end all be all for beer. I will say Chicago is pretty darn impressive when it comes to the beer scene.
Yeah.
They could chill a little bit on the hazy IPAs, but, you know,
for sure.
Get what you can.
Yeah, it's been interesting around here too. And Dovetail leaned into the Kolsch's this year. And I found Kolsch's when I was actually in Germany, and I thought that was just a great thing to have around. But yeah, the golden ales, the classic pilsners, would love to have a lot more of those than the hazies, doubles, triples that are out there. They are making a kind of a bit of a swing for it from a lot of the breweries at this point. So
Yeah. I'm a West Coast IPA guy myself. You'll probably see a lot of that. The hazies themselves, as far as I'm concerned, you might as well have a mimosa. Yeah. I'm done with them. I feel horrible after maybe three, heartburn like crazy. I usually stick to my West Coast.
Year, I probably avoided anything that labels itself as juicy. So
yeah, that's probably a good call. All right. So anyway, you are here. You work for U-Turn. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that journey on the way into U-Turn, how you got started, and, you know, maybe some funny anecdotes along the way.
Yeah. So 2024 will be year 30 for me in the IT industry. So it's been quite the long haul. And if you're doing the math, that means that I and the internet have largely grown up together career-wise. First role was when I was 14, and I was basically doing two different things, supporting a user database for a trumpet windsock dial-in ISP. And it was built around just some really old technology that we don't even talk about now, like modem banks. We had some Lucent modem banks and some other stuff going on there. Everything that came in at that point was not even a tenth or a hundredth, or in some cases a thousandth of the bandwidth that we have access to on a daily basis at this point. I think at one point it took me about 2 weeks to download the original Doom. Get that down and onto floppies and do all the resumes and then make sure that nothing's broken, get it up, installed and running. But yeah, that was my start. So went through from there, kind of grew up, cut my teeth on Slackware from a Linux perspective. When we were running it for that very first job that I had, it was pre 1.0, so we didn't even really have that. Moved through that process, kind of stepped up into the individual contributor role. I mean, there's not much that you can do from a managerial perspective at 14, unless you're growing into the fast food industry. But went through that process, worked for a couple of different early ISPs. Some of them faded and kind of went under. Some of them got gobbled up by other ones. Ended up doing more of a development role for a while, and wrote a fair few early web applications using Perl for all intents and purposes. That was what you had at the time. And for managing like backend and form submission data, everything was full reload. None of this, fully transitive single page app stuff where you don't even notice what's going on in the background. And then along the way, discovered that I really liked leading teams of technical people, and I found myself fairly, kind of, I guess, mid-career at that point, frustrated with non-technical leaders leading technical people and having this kind of back and forth between, I'm telling you what I'm doing, I'm showing you what you're doing, you still don't understand why it's taking so long, or what the problems are because you don't have the technical background yourself. So I really decided that I wanted to lean into that in the long run. I went through a couple of different phases there, leading dev teams, and then landed in infrastructure again, as part of that. Ended up consulting just independently for a few years, and then really started going hard into modern infrastructure. At the time, we were really making the transition from kind of classic, and I say classic, but is anything really classic at this point? But classic virtualized infrastructure using Xen and VMware, and then looking at really the hyper-converged options that were being produced by like Dell and Cisco at the time. And that was kind of the next path forward for a lot of the enterprise infrastructure. And then onto the scene bursts, AWS with, this cloud storage. And that really caught my eye. I got hooked into that. At the same time, I was really also leaning into a company I believed in at the time, Red Hat. And it was a very interesting combination of how do we get stuff done? How do we make it faster? I spent the next few years doing architectural and technical leadership for a couple of different companies. Found that a lot of companies like to talk the talk about reducing their costs and changing their infrastructures, but when it comes down to making the actual investment, even though it's kind of a one-time deal to get it done, they weren't really willing to do that. Started working in cloud infrastructure, Kubernetes, and at that point was working with a competing product that people now know as Mesosphere or DCOS. At the time, it was really just the kludged together combination of Mesos, Marathon, Zookeeper, and hoping that it would stay up and running. So was doing that for a while, ended up going to another company after that, taking on a much more management heavy role, and really leading a team as opposed to being a primary contributor from both a technical and managerial perspective. And that's where I'm at now, right? So my role now is to make sure that the engineers that are working for U-Turn have the things that they need in order to do their jobs well. Make sure that we're able to meet the requirements that our clients put in front of us. And if we have any issues, it's my role to kind of help solve those for the team. And the reality of it too is that comes with some amount of being kind of the protector of the team. And I think that's one of the things that kind of gets missed overall. And one of the reasons that drew me into doing technical management is finding that there are far too many people that are willing to point fingers than ones that are willing to accept responsibility, even if it's not necessarily their responsibility to accept. So, you know, that protection from pigeon style management, as we'll call it, where the shit rains from above, like the team doesn't need that. It just slows them down. It makes them nervous. It makes them not operate at the level that you really want them to. So some of that is my responsibility now, is make sure that I intercept the bad stuff and handle it and get it resolved, and then make sure that the good stuff gets appropriately attributed back out to the team or the individuals that are responsible for it.
Yeah, so pigeon style management, absolutely love that. I've definitely read a lot of stories over the years, you know, intern getting blamed for S3 outages, and, you know, they're like, there's just a major, major things. And yeah, I've been part of teams where AWS key, you know, for production got left in the wrong place, and all of a sudden everything blows up, but they're blaming the one dev that was, whose only job was to run, just create the script and run it. And, you know, this dev had no idea that there were production keys left on a box somewhere and, you know, God knows where. So that's definitely a thing. One thing you said that really, really stuck out to me just over my journey, which started in basically MSPs. So I started after broadband, pretty much got into tech, you know, broadband was out, but it wasn't fast.
Yeah.
And I remember very distinctly, especially once COVID hit, how difficult it was for everyone to get on the VPN at the same time, whenever we'd have like just a snow day.
Yeah.
So, and you said, you know, 56K and ISDN and stuff like that. I could not imagine how crazy that was, and just how different the world is now. You know, the fact that everybody can just work anywhere from a cell phone and nobody will notice. You know, I mean, we've all seen the memes and stuff of guys sitting on the beach with a green screen behind them.
Yeah.
You know, looks about like what I've got going on right here.
Yep.
You know, no problem. And just bandwidth is nothing.
Yeah.
Processing is nothing. CPU, nothing. RAM, nothing.
Think about what we're doing right now. We are having a video podcast. Like,
yeah,
you couldn't do this even really well probably 10 years ago. So,
no, like, especially not at 1080p.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
you know, nice, clear audio, clear visuals. You know, some of that stuff is just crazy when you think about it, like how far we've come. And I really think about it, probably a third or fourth job, you know, was nice enough to be one of those things where I actually had early broadband. You mentioned it a second ago, ISDN. I had a blazing fast 128K dual channel always.
Oh, you got the 128.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I still remember mom ruining my Freebird download because, you know, the Freebird extended version was a solid 13 minutes. So yeah, you try to download that, it's going to take you about 4 days. And every time your neighbor calls,
yep,
it starts over.
It's crazy.
I mean, not that I would pirate music or anything like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah, like Napster wasn't a thing or anything.
No, not at all. All right. So, I mean, now you are the one you're hiring.
Yep.
You know, sounds like you've been through a lot. Do you find some of those foundations that you've come through and some of that stuff that you've learned and whatnot causes any biases in your hiring? Do you find that maybe somebody who comes through who doesn't quite have a grasp on those foundations, do you maybe hit them harder, or do you think of ways, you know, do you think maybe you should bring them up? How do you feel that goes?
Yeah, I really lean into the idea, and U-Turn does as well. And to their credit, that's been some of what we've done is, you know, we're always looking for people with desire and talent and willingness and intelligence. And we've hired quite a few people that go through our process that maybe started out with a lot less than they would have expected, but really applied themselves and got through it. And so some of that probably should take me back to what our hiring process is and why it exists the way it does. You know, in tech hiring right now, there are so many drop gates for candidates, right? Like just even getting your name in front of somebody can be very difficult to begin with. And once you do, then it's like, okay, cool, you made it through our thing. We didn't reject you outright for whatever reason, or our algorithm didn't dump you outright for whatever reason, which is also, I'll come back to that in a second. But, the reality is, like, once you get in front of somebody, then, if you're on the development side, they're, throwing coding challenges at you, which may or may not be relevant. Usually the ones that I've looked at aren't, right, for whatever role that you're sitting in, right? Almost every developer needs to be developing code for a practical application these days. We're not looking for high-end, like, we don't need quants. We don't need, PhDs that are doing like systems level mastery stuff that we have to worry about
We don't need a
for.
manual sorting algorithm to run, to write
Yeah, I mean,
Ansible
well, and
code.
then that's the, like that's, that's my running joke in a lot of cases is like, you can memorize FizzBuzz in 19 different languages, but the likelihood that you're actually going to use FizzBuzz at any point in a development career is very low, right? You have a lot of sorting algorithms that are out there, and there's certainly a use case for it, otherwise it wouldn't exist. But, it's not a problem that is going to properly evaluate what a candidate is capable of, right? In a lot of cases at this point, it's used so often that it's really just gauging whether or not the candidate has had the forethought to memorize the response, right? And I guess that's of a certain type of value. But when you're hiring, when I'm hiring right now, we have a fairly straightforward process. There is really a personality question that goes first. Like, we're a consultancy, U-Turn is a consultancy, and there are people who fit well in that world, right? And there are people that do not, right? And it's rarely a criticism of a person as a whole, but it is an expectation of if you're coming in and you're working in the consulting world, you will have a point in time, probably multiple times a week, where you have to interact with a client and you have to be willing to explain to a client what you did and why you did it. So part of that is the personality fit. You have the personality to be engaging and outgoing from the get-go, right? If it's a 5-minute interaction or a 50-minute interaction or a 5-month interaction with a client, that's something that you're going to have to kind of carry through. So evaluating whether or not somebody's going to fit within that realm is certainly what I do now, but it actually comes from an earlier position where it's making sure that you're just going to fit with the team. So that's the flip side of that coin, right? I don't have a strong valuation of the concept of the Silicon Valley 10x diva, right? Like there are places for them, and that like there are times where I wish that I could just call somebody up and be like, hey, I need this done by next week. Can you just crank it out for me? And cool, that is of value to certain people. But we interoperate, and most of the teams that I've led are about that willingness to work with other people. And so that teamwork effort is high on our checklist as well. So that's really the first stage. Second stage is that classic technical interview, like you're on the phone or on a Zoom or in person with somebody that's really drilling into both your background and what your knowledge set is, how you approach problems, whatever. And from there, if there's a decision that the person that is interviewing has the right kind of technical background, shows the right kind of potential. And again, it's not I know everything, it's the I'm willing to learn stuff is just as important. Then we put them through our technical challenge. And it's not a coding challenge, it's a practical challenge where we put something in front of them. It's not ever used by clients, but it is like a very scoped down version of something
Wait,
that
you're
will
not
allow
hiring these guys to come in and do
them.
free work for you?
Yeah, I think that's actually kind of, it's funny that you asked that because in some cases we've run into people that have run into that. I personally ran into that when I was looking at leaving my last position to this one. It's like, well, we want you to do this. I'm like, well, I'm not willing to do that without you paying me. And so it's geared.
How do you feel about it whenever they do pay you, though? Because I have heard that becoming a thing. If they say, you know, hey, we need you to do, you know, a 4-hour thing, and we're going to pay you X amount of dollars. Obviously, it's set by them.
Here's my thought: if somebody else has decided that 4 hours is the right amount of time for me to complete a project, I hope they're right, right? Because estimating time and inputs for an actual technical result or a deliverable is really, really hard. And right. So am I going to be done in 4 hours? Do you know? How much am I going to be done? What's the quality of it if I am? Like in that project management triangle where you have to choose like the cost, the time, or the quality,
right.
Like what do you get out of that kind of thing? So
yeah.
Our tech challenge is really not geared around that. It's also geared so that our team can evaluate what's being done by somebody because it's consistent. So like we just go through, everything's in there. It is based around the idea that, you know, it's infrastructure as code. We were a Terraform shop. We're still trying to work through the community implications of what that's looked like in the last 6 months. But, you know, it is.
I had an Open Tofu shirt on earlier, actually. Yeah, so, anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's there and it's really, you know, what does that mean? But yeah, I mean, we go through the process and have an expectation, set the expectation, give people a time frame for which they're, you know, responsible for doing a thing. And then we have a panel interview at the end that has both the business and technical resources represented on it so that we can see how somebody is coming in, how they think, right? Like what's one of the things we're trying to gauge? How did you problem solve through some of this stuff? And what are you bringing to the table, right? We're not just looking for, is it technical perfection? That's great if it is, but why is it technical perfection? Like, what did you do? How did you get there? What did you run into? What kind of problems did you have to solve? Because despite the fact that it is a relatively straightforward challenge, that doesn't necessarily mean it's an easy challenge, right? You have so many moving parts out there around AWS, around infrastructure as code itself, around just the resources, whether or not there are resources available in the environment that you're deploying into that could cause you all sorts of problems. So it's like, how do you handle that? And how did you handle it during the process of getting it set up?
You guys should have like a CFO, a mock CFO, and you know, another like technical guy just actually get into it right in the middle of the panel interview. Just have them actually start ripping each other to shreds and just show these new guys exactly what consulting is, which is arguing with technical and financial people all day.
Yeah. Well, the financial people especially, because for in a lot of cases, they don't understand the ROI, right? Like the return on investment. What are they getting for their dollars is really hard for them to gauge. I think from our perspective, one of the reasons that our hiring process is the way that it is that at any point somebody could end up on a call and not necessarily have the immediate support they need to be in that kind of situation and successfully rebut that kind of pressure. Right. So being able to like walk back from that, you know, come back to it later with, you know, either another senior technical resource or a leadership resource that is ready to say, hey, look, I heard you ask these questions. Let's talk about what you're actually after. What do you need? So, you know, at the end of this panel interview, our hope is that we have found somebody that has successfully completed the challenge. But even if they haven't, like, have they shown the right amount of drive and effort, and have they problem solved correctly? So we're not necessarily looking for it to be done and done correctly, especially at the junior level, right? What we are looking for is understanding how you approached it. And if you had had more time, would that be successful, right? Would you be able to coach yourself through it? And I would say that like a fair few of our engineers now have come to the table and said, I don't know Terraform. I'm going to have to learn it to do this challenge. And then a week or 10 days later, they're like, well, I learned Terraform and I did this. It's not going to be perfect, but I think it works. I mean, that in and of itself is a huge part of the consulting world, just because we don't know what weird stuff or ancient stuff people are going to throw at us that we have to go figure out in that week.
Yep. No, I've been using ChatGPT to simplify some things lately, and that whole 2-year gap Has a lot of differences, especially when you're dealing with something like Terraform that, you know, changes every day. I mean, my course has broken multiple times thanks to them rolling out new things and stuff like that. And yeah, you know, I rolled something out for a lab from a new course the other day, and it's just like, I looked at it once. I was like, okay, cool. This looks great. Then I looked at it again. I was like, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Went back and rewrote the whole thing from scratch. So, I think, that ability to actually solve problems and reason through them is huge.
Yeah.
What would you recommend for somebody to develop that skill? What do you think people are doing wrong here that is leading to a lot of people not being able to do it? As in, why, you know, it's obviously a question on the test because people do actually fail it.
Yeah.
So what do you think people need to be doing a little bit different if they're falling into that trap?
So, like, here's the trick, and it's important, but people skip it now. Like, people are going straight to, what do I need to learn to get certified, or what do I need to learn to do X, right? That's not necessarily a bad thing. If you have a target that you have to approach and get something done, it's going to happen in your career multiple times where you just have to go figure it out, and it's not going to be perfect. But the problem comes later when you have to understand why something worked or why something didn't work. We hear it all the time from the sports world, and I realize that a huge portion of the audience here is not going to be sports ball oriented, but it's okay.
You'd be surprised.
Because
it is, we do half the show is beer. We've probably got a couple.
Right. But you know, getting back to fundamentals is really important, and there's, you know, if you go look at what people were looking at getting certified on, not 2 years ago or 5 years ago, but 10 years ago, 20 years ago, like, networking fundamentals are really important. You have to understand why the network communication works the way that it does. You need to at least understand the basics around the different protocols in use and why they're out there and what the impact is, right? Like,
I've troubleshot a spanning tree before, and if I ever have to do that again, I think I'm going to quit tech.
Yeah. I mean, or, you know, you get a BGP broadcast storm, or you get something else that's in there. Like, and you don't have to know all of it, but you need to be able to know, like, where to start and what that means. Mm-hmm. So, like, network fundamentals, OS fundamentals, like, we're well past the diss on Windows because you can only do anything with a GUI stage. We have been for a long time, right? Like,
right.
You can run a headless Windows server, and as long as you understand PowerShell, you're good to go, right? And it's so understanding, like, OS level fundamentals for whatever your operating system of choice is, and it doesn't have to be, you know, kind of, I look at it as both sides, but there's, like, the kind of expansion out there, and, you know, depending on which corner of the internet you hang out on, you could be saying that there's nothing better than X, which is a tale as old as tech, right? You know, I hang out on lobsters a lot just because I like the content that it throws up. But if you do, you'd almost expect that the only thing out there on any given day is either Rust, Nix, or Clojure, which...
Werner just went all over the place about Rust, didn't he? I think that was the keynote. It was just like, if you're not learning Rust, you shouldn't be learning, or something like that. He went all in.
And he, like, I love Werner. I think he's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, to be fair, I really appreciate the Dutch sense of humor in general.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the idea that you should have to go down a specific learning path doesn't make sense to me, because everybody learns differently, right?
Right.
Everybody's brain works a different way. And just because I hate Lisp or I hate Clojure doesn't mean that that somebody else shouldn't do it, right?
Right.
I love working with Rust. I love the idea of Rust with it being so constrained. But I struggle with it on the daily when I'm messing around with things. So, like, the idea that I'm going to be, like, more than just basically functional in Rust with my current role is pretty low. On the other hand, I do love Python, right? And so if somebody comes to me and says, how would you approach this? I'd be like, well, if nothing else, I'd do the POC in Python, right? Not everybody's there, but... going back to like the learning process is you should have at your core an understanding of a programming language because that logic is going to help you, right? If you're going into infrastructure as code, you need to understand the code part, right? Why does it work? Why
Yeah,
does
the
it not
patterns are huge, the data
work?
structures, all of that type of stuff. That stuff is all shared. I mean, one might be a bracket, one might be a brace, but at the end of the day,
And
it's all
I
the
don't
same
think
type
that
of
everybody needs to
idea.
go through and learn every single Gang of Four design pattern,
Yeah.
but it won't hurt you if you do, right?
Right.
It's really going through and again those understandings. So like from networking, know the basics. Operating systems, know the basics, right? Like how do you troubleshoot? What does it mean when you get certain messages
Yeah,
that are
I
going to
think
crop up?
researching those messages is such a big thing, and just knowing where to look. I think, a lot of the questions I get all the time is, how do I solve this problem? I'm like, I don't know. What's the log? And they show me the log, and it's like right there. It's like, permission denied. It's like, oh, well, maybe your key is wrong, or maybe your password's wrong, or whatever. It's usually pretty straightforward once you really dive in and just stop, concentrate, take a breath, and dive in.
For sure. I'd say along with that too is, on the development side, in your language of choice, learn how to read a stack trace, right? This is it's not fun, but when you
No,
have to
it's
like,
not.
but when somebody's especially from the consulting world, right? Like we deal with all sorts. We deal with dev teams, we deal with infrastructure teams, we deal with business teams. And if you have to go back to one of the more technical teams that you're working with and say, we can't fix this for you because it is a problem within your thing. Like, first off, the blame language there is already going to put people on the defensive, right? This is your problem. I cannot fix it for you,
Yeah, at the
right?
hosting company, that's exactly what it was. It was us and the developers fighting constantly. They're like, no, your server went down. I'm like, no, your application went down. And it would go on for sometimes weeks.
And it's, I mean, it is a hard social problem to tackle to get people to understand that, like, I cannot fix a problem that is not my problem to fix, right? And I'm not like the way that English works specifically makes it very hard to say, this is a problem of your creation, but it is not necessarily your problem. That's a lot to put out there in a single phrase. And it still lends itself in certain ways to making people defensive about this being something that they have to fix because it's in their court rather than something that you have to fix because you found the problem, right? Going through all of that, those fundamentals of how do you get to that point? How do you become like an AWS solutions architect or whatever Google calls their people, or like the I or Microsoft certified solutions architect. Those roles
Ooh,
are there for a reason.
MCSA.
They're there, and certifications do exist for a certain reason, right? They're a rule of just tabulation that you can do on a candidate. Be like they put in the effort, and they should know at least this. But I will say that being able to know what's on the exam specifically related to the content that they're testing you on does not make you that person, right? Does not make you a person that can fill that role. I have had no shortage of people that have come and said, "Hey, I'm AWS certified. I should be able to do this." You start asking them questions that are outside the boundaries of that AWS certification, and suddenly, you get the, deer in the headlights of a Mack truck look of how do I do it? And that's where that's gonna help you. Like, there's also the thing that you don't have to know everything. Like, there are going to be hiring managers out there that want you to know everything that they think you should know. You're not a mind reader. I'm not a mind reader. I try not to structure our hiring process like that, but being able to and willing to say, I don't know right now, but I can find out and I'll get back to you is one of the biggest things you can do to avoid stepping in a giant pile of crap and then having to worry about the smell later, right? It's easier just to say, I can't move forward rather than I'm willing to move forward and take the hit. That, you know,
It's interesting too, though. Like, so people are so terrified in an interview or whatever of being wrong, but also like in the real world, I mean, I get questions all the time. People are like, how do I do this? Or, you know, this isn't working or whatever. And I'm kind of like, well, what have you tried? They're like, well, I've read the instructions. I'm like, you have a free tier that covers like 90% of AWS.
Yep.
You've got Terraform, you've got billing alarms set, I hope, and get in there and get dirty, break something. Who cares? Yep. Like if your RDS instance doesn't work, you didn't pay a dime.
Yeah.
You lost about, well, it's RDS, so you lost about an hour of your time. But, you know, really, like, I find a lot of people are just terrified of just running things until it works. Like, this stuff isn't going to break anything permanently unless you break out the sledgehammer or get, you know, RMRF slash. For the most part, you're not going to break anything. So get out there and get dirty.
I mean, and these days, too, like, if you're clever about things, if you're learning in a progressive order, if you are going to try something that you know might break stuff, like it takes 10 seconds to do a snapshot of your EC2 instance, right? Or, you know, of your whatever you're using, you know, your Azure instance or your Azure VM, I think is what it is. You know, same thing. Even in home labs these days, like being able to just snapshot a running VM before you go and change stuff, so fast, so easy. There should be very little fear about changing things in non-production environments that might break stuff. Just be cognizant of like what you might need to do to fix it, right? If that fix is, I broke it, it doesn't even boot, the answer is restore from your snapshot and you're good probably inside 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's how I did my entire RHCSA. I didn't have a course to use. I just went and, I mean, I had Linux Academy, but you know, they had their own labs or whatever, their sandboxes. You're not actually getting in there and getting dirty with it. So I created my own instances and I, on VMware, of course, and I created snapshots right before every single lesson. I would do a lesson.
Yep.
Create a snapshot before it. I'd go in, I'd break a bunch of stuff, I'd kick a bunch of things around, get weird with it. And then once I got it all successful, I'd snapshot it again. I would save those snapshots and I ended up with a full string of labs.
Yeah.
I was actually able to just go through every single day and start with the first snapshot and just keep building up to the next one and the next one and the next one. And I ended up, it's my first. I got Cisco first, CCNA, couple Microsofts, but then I honestly say the Red Hat one was the first one where I just really felt out of water.
Yeah.
That was a fun one. That one really, really changed my perspective on the tech industry.
I think it's interesting. And certainly I have my own very public opinions on where Red Hat is now, but for a long time they were at the forefront of what I considered a quality certification, right? So with the RHCSAs, which are a little bit more about like how do you do a thing. But by the time you get to the RHCE, like when I went through that and when I renewed it, it was very much about how is it broken and how do you fix it, right? So those are very high quality, in my opinion, types of certifications where they are purely practical. You know, at the end of the thing, you don't submit an exam. You shut down your VM and submit your VM, right?
And you're giving me chills. Like just thinking about shutting it down and walking out of the room, and I'm just terrified. I'm like, what did I do wrong?
Yeah. And, you know, but welcome to the real world, folks. Like sometimes that's what happens. You're done with a project and you hand it off. And it's not yours anymore. And you're crossing your fingers thinking like, did I do everything as best I could? Right.
Yeah. Where's that red team waiting to ruin my life?
Yeah. Well, and these days they're just around the corner. I mean, it's really important to make sure that wherever you are now, if you're not able to go back and like work through a regular type of problem that is OS oriented or network oriented or programming language oriented, like there's something that you're probably missing from your technical skill set that is going to help you be better at anything else that you do, right? So once you start building one of those foundations, the other ones will be somewhat easier for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, yeah. Where they're going to start making the links between, oh, I understand how it works on my VM or on my instance, and I understand the impact of making these changes. So when I go through and I start writing a Python or Perl script, or, you know, you're a little more cool and new age and you're doing the Clojure or Lisp stuff, or, you know, you're very much leaning into the like strict type stuff around Rust, like, yeah. All of those things are going to make more sense. Maybe not the Borrows and Rust, but everything else will make more sense. And it'll be easier to start expanding your knowledge and learning the stuff that's really going to set you apart from your peers if you have the ability to go learn faster.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think a lot of people get so hung up on what's popular right now.
Yeah.
They don't realize that everything that's popular right now is based off something that's was popular yesterday. And,
right.
You know, learn the thing that gets you out the door. Learn the thing that gets you moving. Learn the thing that gets something built. It doesn't matter what it is. If you're learning, if PHP is what you got to learn to do it, do it. You're going to be able to move to Python and anywhere else you've got to go. And you're probably going to beat your head into the wall enough to be able to handle anything anybody else has to throw at you. So,
yeah. I mean, PHP comments aside, because I agree with you there. And Jeff Wagner, if you're out there watching this, this one's for you. PHP has come a long way, right? Like when it was a derivative of Perl, like the early ones, the PHP 2 mm-hmm. CPI stuff, PHP was when I started getting into it and actually started, like, somewhere out there on the internet, if it's not completely dead, you know, I've got a few commits in the early PHP stuff. And that's why I feel entitled to rag on it as much as I do. But it also
moved the
internet in a way that nothing else that came before it did, right?
I mean,
it made
WordPress.
It easier. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, but it in general, it made it easier to build web applications, right?
Yeah.
It made it so that you didn't have to be a hardcore developer to go and do that stuff. But your ability to go out and build a business and learn enough to do it was the foundation of so many things that are out there now. I mean, even I watched the Rails documentary that popped up a little bit ago, and I think it was last week or the week before, and I was like, I disagree with all of this, and I'm not a Ruby person, but like, you know, the fact that Rails exists and it's out there, and that, like, Basecamp became a thing, and it really moved the way that we work as developers for better or for worse, is like, that's a thing. And you can see, like, you can follow that path through the internet, but they wouldn't have done that. But the thing that got me, though, is like, talking about PHP and how it was just absolutely awful at the time.
Right.
And to be fair, it's still pretty awful in my opinion, but nobody has to share my opinion, right? It's there. I think that like there are some real value adds to, if you can learn it, if you can do it, it is certainly a great starting point. And if it interests you and it holds your interest and makes you willing to learn more, then definitely by all means, keep writing stuff in notes.
I think for people like me, you know, a little bit ADD, and don't get me wrong, I didn't start with PHP, but whatever the fastest thing to actually be able to iterate on, the fastest thing to give me a result is what I'm looking for. And, you know, Python's one of those. It's like, you know, I took Harvard CS50. If you haven't taken it and you want to learn some of this stuff, get out there and do it. It starts with C. And then it's like, all right, remember all that stuff we just did with, you know, varchars and all of this other stuff? Well, watch how we do it in Python. And then you see it done in like 5 lines versus 40. And you realize, you know, just whatever it takes to get you out the door and get you building is what matters.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think that's the big thing. I will also throw my endorsement behind that. Especially the CS50P course. If you're not feeling like you're ready to tackle a lower level language, CS50P is a great place to like really get some development chops running. And Harvard has done a great job with making that free and making that available to anybody. And I think that there's a lot worse things that you could do with your life than spend, you know, a few days working through each CS50P problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. 100%. I talk to people who have like about those problems and they're just like, yeah, this is all stuff I've either had interviews on, I've been through, we've talked about, or I did in university, you know, like this is all really big stuff. So yeah, if there's anybody out there who needs to get started, there's a good spot.
It's a great spot.
Yep. Well, man, that was fantastic information. I think I'm going to charge for this podcast now.
That's great.
just kidding.
What's my cut?
we'll see. But, you know, based on all of that really excellent information, if you had to just narrow it down to just one thing that you told people when they're getting into their tech journey, when they're starting, or we can even say one thing for beginners and one thing for the people who just, the guy who just got laid off, you know, the normal developer, I won't say senior, but like the normal developer who just got laid off. So one thing for each of those people, somebody breaking in and somebody who got broken in, had one or two jobs and then just got that layoff that just came through, you know, this year.
I'm actually going to throw it out there, and we've been talking about it for basically the last 20 minutes, and it's the same for both, right? Being a continuous learner, being willing to go out and find the thing that you don't know, or maybe you don't know well, and learning it better, especially, you know, once we get tied into whatever job path we're in, that saps a lot of time, right? That saps a lot of energy. And unless you're actually actively being encouraged and given the time and being paid to do the learning that you need to do, like that goes by the wayside. You tend to stagnate in career, right? So some of the most excellent advances that I think I made in my own knowledge have actually come between jobs, right? So I have to go out and I have to figure out what's changed or what's different, because when I go interview for the next job, they're not going to ask me what I knew 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. They're going to ask me about things that are happening in the industry right now. And if they're really bad recruiters, they're asking me about things that they think have been happening in the industry and don't actually exist yet. So there's, you know, you have to be able to qualify and quantify the types of questions that you're going to get from what's coming next in order to, if that's your goal, to get back into that role. The other thing is, like, it may not be your goal to get back into that same type of role. You may not want to be a developer anymore. I mean, certainly I've had points of burnout in my life where technical wasn't really what I wanted to do. I spent 4 months as a commercial plumber. I mean, it taught me a whole lot of stuff. It also taught me I don't really want to be a commercial plumber, but like I learned a whole lot in that period. And if you realize that what you have been doing isn't the thing that you want to keep doing for the rest of your career, like the best time to make that change, as they say, was yesterday, but the next best time is tomorrow, right? So like, or today, and you know, really just depends on who you talk to, but like, learning the thing that you want to do, or figuring out learning if that's what you don't want to do, is just as important. So the continuous learning aspect in every aspect of your career journey, whatever that happens to be, whether it's you're going straight, continuing on as, you know, infrastructure SA, or developer, or, you know, designer, whatever you're doing, like that's great. If you take a hard left, take a hard left. Like if that's going to be a better path for you, figuring that out quickly because you've learned something about it is really a good thing.
Yep. So just continuously poke, just constantly, just see what's out there.
There is the theory that curiosity killed the cat, but how do you learn anything if you're not curious about it, right? So you don't have to be curious about everything, but finding the right curiosity for you as a person, I think is going to lead you to a better path. Whoever you are out there listening right now, it's like, it will be one of those things where you will stumble upon something that makes you really think and say, is this a better way to do something? And you could, there've been so many inventions that have just come because somebody was curious about like why. Better coding techniques that come out because of why, right? So why does it happen? I think that one of my favorite thing is things in the past, and I think it was somewhere around season 10 of The Simpsons goes in, and I think it might be Edison's workshop or whatever. And Homer's like, I could be an inventor, right? And I was like, sure, anybody can invent stuff. He goes through and realizes that, like, the things that he had been inventing were all things that he like saw in that workshop. Like the chair that leans back and has the extra legs to prevent you from falling over. Yeah. And, you know, it's just really funny. It's like, just because you go through and think that this is a new thing and you realize somebody else has done it does not make that a bad invention for
just
you.
Just don't invent Homer's car. Right. And we'll be okay.
Right. Or the Canyon Arrow. Right. But yeah, like the continuous learning aspect cannot be underrated, for especially for the technical field, for the people that are going to be listening to this type of podcast. Like, you have to let your curiosity run wild a little bit and figure out what's out there and why is it out there. Like, somebody didn't just go and invent Rust because they thought it was, you know, cool. They thought they were going to invent Rust to fix a specific problem. And that's
right.
Like going through and thinking about, like, what do I need to do to satiate whatever my drive is? What problem am I addressing? So
yeah, I think when the problem is to pass a certification, you're not thinking big enough.
Right.
Start actually solving real problems and change that mindset.
Right. I mean, it's a good goal, and it should.
Yeah.
When people inevitably, like, I don't think that there's a good way to memorize enough to get a perfect pass on most certifications, right?
Right.
You're going to have holes in that. Yep. At the point, if you're the type of person that is driven by that kind of result, like it had to be perfect, you shouldn't be asking just why wasn't it perfect. It's what am I missing in my knowledge set, and what can I learn to make sure that next time it's perfect, right?
Right, right.
I don't really care about perfection. So what I care about is the practical applications of things, the pragmatic applications of things, documentation of things. Like, how does it work, and why does it work that way? Coming back to one of the things you asked earlier for, like, what I look for in people is – the explanation in person or over the phone or over Zoom or whatever it is of how it works is great, but you're not always going to be present to do that. Writing your thoughts down, or even now just capturing them, right? We have so many utilities that do just like voice capture and will write stuff down for you, capture it, throw it out there, right? Yeah. That's a huge one too. Being able to regurgitate what you have knowledge of in a way that is repeatable, which usually means the written word.
Right, right, right. No, absolutely. 100%.
All right. What else you got, man, Derek? Throw something hard at me.
I think that's, damn, you have taken me out. Let's see. I think we mostly got it. Honestly, what else do you have for me? What else do you have to say? You know, based on, you know, you guys hiring, are you,
you're
expanding? What are you looking for?
Yeah. I mean, we're always looking for the right people to come in and fill roles, right? We're growing. We had the incredible adventure of growing through the pandemic. So, you know, we're probably a fairly 50% wise workforce, remote workforce. The roles that we're hiring for are always out there, even if we're not hiring for them at this point, because everybody's I say everybody, but a lot of the companies that were kind of those mid-market companies that had not looked at moving to cloud-based infrastructure are starting to take a really hard look at that. So looking out there, kind of understanding what those roles are, data is a huge thing. So, you know, if you're interested in data and kind of what it means in the real world, go down that path. I think you poked at me a little bit earlier too. You asked me a little bit like about recruiters, and I will say that there's like I have a very strong opinion of, about recruiters. And I think that it's in the tech world they're absolutely necessary, right? But there are so many recruiters that don't understand the roles that they're recruiting for, and they don't understand the people that they're trying to slot into those roles. They're looking at keywords, right, on a page. Like the job rec has keywords here. The resume of the candidate has the keywords here. Those match up. They should be a good fit. So, you know, whatever. You almost have to, in order to get through the front door in a lot of places, work with a recruiter now. But the recruiter you should be working with is the one that's also working for you.
So you're going to hate what I just found out today.
What's that?
I've got a friend. I talked to him earlier, and he sent me a picture. And I was kind of looking. I was like, none of this makes any sense. And then I looked a little closer, and I realized he's working with a virtual recruiter, fully virtual. It's already happening. It's looking at these keywords, like you just said, matching them up and just slinging them at people.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that has been the trend for at least the last 20 years, right?
Are you trying to say a bunch of if statements make up a machine learning algorithm?
I'm trying to say that I can replace quite a few recruiters with a very small shell script.
Right.
but the good ones are worth more than their weight in platinum, right? So, I would say be very cognizant of the people that you're working with and whether or not they're working for you. There's always going to be people in every industry that don't care, right? They don't have any investment in the work that they're doing. When they pick it up each day, it's just a job. And that can be fine for a lot of things. And I've written articles about the necessity of having the people that are willing and comfortable with the idea that a repeatable day is a good day, right? Like if I'm doing the same thing all the time, I don't have to worry about variation or surprises. That's a good day. There is, in my mind, no position within recruiting that is not full of surprises. And so the people that you're working with have to have the attitude that you, the candidate, the thing that they're shopping to somebody, should be one of their clients' surprises, right? Like a good one. And they should know what you're looking for, why you're looking for it. They should be able to tell you, hey, I found these five jobs that I wanted to submit you for, but I only submitted you for two because these other three were X, Y, and Z. It doesn't have to be a long conversation, but a good recruiter should show that they understand both the role that they're recruiting for and the person that they're trying to recruit into that role, and be able to pre-qualify them for, you know, that conversation with the hiring company. Right.
Yeah.
And so I try and source a lot of our candidates, but we do work with recruiters for that. And our best recruiters bring those to us on a regular basis. And if they don't work out, it's not usually because they don't have the right personality, because the recruiter has learned what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And it's not usually because they don't have the technical skills, because the recruiter has figured out what we're looking for there as well. What it is it's just not a right fit for us at this time for that person. Quite a few of the good candidates that have come through recruiters that I enjoy working with are still in my Rolodex for me to go back to that recruiter, especially within whatever time frame that it is, and say, hey, can you find out if this person is on the market or unhappy with what they're doing right now?
I know a lot of people who wonder if that actually happens. So I think that's going to be comforting to a lot of people.
Yeah. And like, there's probably some, you know, as an aside, like just as a complete shift out of that, you guys, like your audience should be aware, if they're not, that there are specific restrictions and requirements around working with a recruiting agency, right?
Right.
If you're not aware, and I hope you are, but if you're not, like if a recruiter submits you for a role, in most of the contractual language that companies have signed, you are required to be hired through that recruiting company for the finder's fee for a period of time. That can be 6 months, that can be a year. It's usually not longer than that, but for executive or higher level positions, it can be, right? So when you go back and look for a new role at, say, the same company, and you start working with a different recruiter and you're submitted for that role, a lot of people are like, well, why did they reject me? Well, if you get double submitted in that time
Yep.
frame, a lot of companies aren't going to want to worry about the problem that comes along with that.
I've been yelled at for it. I've actually had a recruiter actually get viscerally angry at me. I mean, I was like 24 at the time. I'm sorry, guys. I don't know your commission basis. Not really supposed to be my problem, but unfortunately, it does spill over.
And it does. So most companies, as opposed to like hiring you, even if you're a highly qualified candidate specifically for that role, will instead just straight up kick your resume out and say, we're not going to consider this person at all because they were already submitted within a time frame, right? It's super important that you're aware of that, and that recruiters get paid because they found you, right? So like the average tech recruiter commission is 20%. So that's 20% of your 4 years annual salary that comes to them. Of course, like if the recruiter's job is to make sure that they're getting the most money out of submitting you to the company as they can get, which means that if you tell a recruiter that your salary range is 105 to 130, like it's just got a huge gap in it, but it's like it depends on what the role is and like if I'm a good fit and all that kind of stuff. Like your personal decisions, generally a good recruiter will listen to them, but they're still going to tell the company on the other end that you're looking for 130, right? Even if that's not true. And so you have to understand that if you go and say, hey, I'm experienced. Let's say I have, 10 years of experience. I'm looking for a senior role in today's market. I'm, in a tech-friendly area, so East Coast, Chicago, Austin, West Coast, like primary tech targets right now. Like if you go and look at the high end of those salaries and you're looking to move to either a smaller market or whatever, recruiter goes in and says, hey, this person's looking for 250. Right? A company is going to kick you to the curb. Like they're not going to have that much play in their financials to hire somebody no matter how much they want them. And a recruiter is going to tell you, hey, if they really want you, they're going to figure out how to make it work. That is probably true one time out of 10. But like a lot of companies that are looking to hire for growth purposes. And so like they have to balance the value of what you're bringing to the table. You are an unknown quantity as a candidate coming in. Like if you're asking for something that they can't pay, but the recruiter's saying that's what you're worth, like I'm not going to try and waste your time. So, like from a recruiting standpoint, that's super important because you want a recruiter to get paid, right? They're doing their job to make sure that like they're chasing them down. And I have recruiters that are like, hey, you said you were going to get back to me today about this candidate. Where did you do that? Well, my day goes sideways every day. So, like, it's good to have those little nagging voices in your ear, but by the same token, that's how they get paid. They're making their money on the back end of that deal. When you get hired, then usually within 60 to 90 days, the recruiter's getting paid. So it's in their best interest to do that. But it's also in their best interest to get the most out of the hiring company that they can for you so that they get the biggest dollar figure on their side. I am not saying that that's a bad thing, but I feel like the more that I talk to people, the more that I go through this process from the hiring standpoint, is a lot of people, especially younger folks who are just coming in, like just out of college, are not familiar with that process, right? And not familiar with how it works. I will also tell you that there's like, while I do a lot of sourcing for my candidates, I go through LinkedIn for a lot of them. I'll post jobs and
That was actually
everything.
my next question, was where you generally source candidates for yourself.
I found like a lot of quality before like Reddit really kind of shat the bed.
That's actually
I
where
would,
I got my first job. My
right?
first tech job actually was through Reddit, but that was a long time ago.
Right. But and so I will look all over. I reach out to people that I know have looked in the past. Like I have my own personal Rolodex. I have been known to poach people that worked for me before and bring them to companies. If that's really important, or people that they're willing to recommend, right? Because there is a huge amount of truth in it's not who you, not what you know, it's who you know. Like there, that network is important when you're looking for a job. Going to meetups and everything and meeting people and being, willing to interact will help you find some of those things and get through that first level thing that you may not get through, unless you know somebody or a recruiter's willing to break open that door for you, right? So I do source a lot of those, the filter questions, right? These are not AI questions. If I post a job out there, I'm not running people through an algorithm. I'm looking through those resumes myself, or at a minimum, looking through the very short list of questions that I post out there. Like I ask specific questions. How many years of experience do you have with X, right? I have had people respond that they have 15 years of experience with Kubernetes. And I'm like, that's freaking amazing because,
You invented
right? Like, were you there on the Borg design team at Google that was like, we're gonna pivot to BSD jails and then we're gonna go to like Solaris zones and none of this works out. So, oh yeah, Linux is doing containers now. Like that. There is a reality of like looking through that. If somebody is putting unrealistic information on those filter questions, they get tossed immediately. So, but in reality, back to the recruiter stuff is like work with a recruiter. Find a recruiter or a couple of recruiters that you like, that like you, that are going to work on your behalf, that are willing to understand you. They'll go to work. Like they will work hard, right? I've had recruiters that have since left the industry, but they will call me. They'll be like, "Hey, I know you're not looking, but it's like because they'll call me. They know what I'm bringing to the table. You find the right recruiters, they're going to do the same for you. They'll continue to work on your behalf, just because if you are good at what you do, if you bring something solid to the table, and those recruiters place you 4 times in your career, like the money they get paid each time they place you goes up." Your stock goes up with that recruiter, but also they'll work to find those new roles. They'll work to get you in or talk a hiring manager around the, oh, this is a hard requirement. Is it? Is it really? Like, I've had a candidate that's pretty good at that, but they don't have like everything that you're asking for. Would you be okay with me bringing them to the show? Would you like to see their resume? Like, that's what they'll do for you. And in this day and age, you have to have that. You have to have an
No, for
advocate,
sure.
right? So, cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of really good information. I think we actually got 2 episodes out of this one.
Cool.
Where the hell can we find you?
I'm definitely out there on LinkedIn. I have a group that's out there for DevOps, SRE, platform engineering professionals. It's pretty tiny. It's not super active right now, but you can definitely pop in there. I'm gonna try and hopefully, like everybody's got a 2024 plan or a next year plan. I'm hoping to be like running that group a little bit more actively next year. You can always find me at like sjsadowski.com. I'm out there for sure. I'm involved with a Python open source web framework called Sanic. It's out there.
Yeah, I know Santa. That's awesome.
So try and be involved there. Pretty often. And yeah, I mean, I'm out on Mastodon, all that kind of stuff, but you can definitely find me at sjsadowski.com. I've got links to most of that stuff out there. Got links to my GitHub, of which is probably super dated. I don't really have a lot of public stuff out there these days.
No, that's fine. I think we're all kind of in that place overall. Yeah. I've got some PowerShell programs on my GitHub still that I probably need to go
and mark as hidden. Like, I don't actually know what's public anymore.
We'll post it all, of course, on the episode description and all of that good stuff, so everybody can get a hold of you. Because it's been fantastic.
For sure.
A lot of really great information. Well, I can't even say how excited I am. This conversation was so good. The beer was actually pretty great too. I hope you enjoyed yours.
I did. Yep.
That's fantastic. Well, this is Derek Morgan signing off with Steven Sadowski. Go ahead and say bye to everybody.
Hey, everybody. Have a great evening. Or whenever you're listening to this podcast.
Cheers.
Cheers.